WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
All week, we're taking a look at how our art, our culture, our entertainment will continue to be affected by the coronavirus pandemic and what changes implemented during 2020 might just carry over into 2021. Today, we turn to the film industry. Movies provided much needed escape for many of us in 2020. But as it became clear that movie going, for the most part, would be limited to our couches and occasional drive-ins, theaters and studios struggled to figure out possible solutions. For many films, like the highly anticipated movies Dune and In the Heights, that meant pushing back release dates until 2021. For others, like Disney's Mulan, it meant charging big ducats for families to watch at home on Disney Plus. And for Warner Brothers Studios, it meant cutting a deal with HBO Max to stream their slate of 17 films in 2021, a move that many in the industry have criticized as being bad for theaters, as well as directors and actors. So how might the streaming wave of 2020 carry over into 2021? And how will content continue to be affected by COVID? Will productions take longer due to quarantining and testing? Fewer crowd scenes. How will the 2021 Oscars be different this year besides the fact that they're happening in April? Here to walk us through what we might be able to expect from film in 2021 is Kyle Buchanan, pop culture reporter at the New York Times and the paper's award season columnist called The Projectionist. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Allison.
So in a year where so many theaters were closed, films turned to streaming services for the releases. And one of the biggest changes to the movie landscape is that HBO Max deal with Warner Brothers. The studio is set to release 17 films simultaneously in theaters and for streaming on HBO Max. The first of these films was Wonder Woman, 1984. We'll talk about that in a minute. When you first heard about this deal, what was your reaction?
I was gobsmacked, to put it mildly. And I know I'm not alone because the filmmakers who made those movies were gobsmacked. And a little bit litigious, I've even heard. You know, this is uncharted territory. And I can't stress to you enough how uncharted it is. You know, movies like Wonder Woman 1984 and Dune, they're greenlit at a price point, usually above $200 million in their budgets, because they're expected to make over $1 billion in the theater, you know. And prior to that HBO Max announcement, I just thought there was no way you'd see something like Wonder Woman 1984 on HBO Max, because who's going to pass up a $1 billion windfall? There's just no other way to make up that money. Disney didn't make it up with Mulan, so why would they shuttle off something like Dune to HBO Max? And the answer is streaming. You know, HBO Max and Warner Brothers, for that matter, are all owned by AT&T. And the corporate priority there was clearly to shore up a struggling streaming service so that they could get it somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, more successful ventures like Netflix and Disney Plus. And they are willing to burn billions that they might have gotten otherwise to do that. That is crazy, and that is staggering. And what that really, really is different. You know, the movie industry has said before, and I've heard a lot of people saying it now, that they fended off all sorts of challenges in the past. You know, the invention of television, the internet, etc. But this is one challenge that I think is going to reshape this industry forever. There's no turning back.
You talk about burned. A lot of people feel burned. One talent agent told The Hollywood Reporter, quote, "Warner's has made a grave mistake. Never have this many people been upset with one entity." So if you could just walk it through, people who don't necessarily understand like points and back-end deals and things like this, who stands to lose money by these films going to streaming?
Well, honestly, everybody stands to lose money, except for maybe AT&T stockholders. But directors and actors often, you know, especially if it's a very big movie that's expected to make $1 billion, they'll have a percentage written into their contract. So after the movie, you know, recoups its budget, they'll make a solid chunk of whatever the profits are. That can be enormous if you're a big star or a major director. We're talking over 50 million, sometimes skirting 100 million. It really just depends. So in a lot of cases, you know, AT&T had really not worked out what to do about those things. In Wonder Woman 1984's case, because they announced that sort of separate from the announcement of their whole slate going on to HBO Max, they had already made deals with people like Gal Gadot, the star of that film, Patty Jenkins, the director of that film, to sort of pay a lump sum that they might have gotten if that movie was the success in theaters that they had projected. But for people like, you know, Denis Villeneuve, who directed The New Dune, or Timothy Chalamet, who stars in it, there wasn't anything. There wasn't any even advance notice that this would be happening. In order to keep this announcement secret, AT&T and Warner Brothers didn't tell a soul. So these actors and directors were not just upset that their movies that they, you know, poured their hearts and souls into were being shuttled unceremoniously to a streaming service. They're also upset because they have no idea, and they had gotten no assurances up to that point, if they're going to make the money that they'd planned to make on them.
My guest is Kyle Buchanan. He is the projectionist for the New York Times and award season columnist. We're talking about the future of movies. You know, since we've talked about Wonder Woman, I'm just going to jump over there. The Business Insider said that Wonder Woman debuted simultaneously in theaters and on HBO Max in the U.S. on Christmas Day, and it grabbed headlines for grossing the biggest pandemic-era opening weekend at the domestic box office with $16.7 million. Now, it dropped off a ton the following week. The reviews were not great. When you think about this, what do you think we learned from this?
Well, you know, one thing you can say about Warner Brothers, and maybe it's not even purposeful, it's just what they've had to do, is they have been the canary in the coal mine in a lot of ways this past year. Whether it's, you know, shoving their movies onto a streaming service, or whether it's taking these big blockbusters and releasing them into theaters just to see what happens, as they did earlier this year with Tenet. You know, a lot of things that are shaking up the industry are happening at Warner Brothers, which is traditionally a very traditional studio. What we found with Tenet in particular, because that was a movie that came out that had all the contours of a blockbuster and did not come out on streaming at the same time, is that people were not ready to go back to the movie theaters. You know, the pandemic is still raging. I don't know that people had complete faith that theaters would be a safe space for them. And in the case of Wonder Woman 1984, you know, this is the tricky thing. Again, I don't think people are quite ready to go back to theaters. That's why that box office was depressed. But it's also obviously depressed by the fact that people can so easily watch that at home. And, you know, assurances were made to the filmmakers, Patty Jenkins, who directed that film, and then also a lot of the filmmakers who made movies that are supposed to come out this year on HBO Max but weren't originally intended to. A lot of assurances were made, well, yes, it will come out on HBO Max, it will come out on streaming, but only in the U.S. In the rest of the world, it will come out in theaters, so you'll be able to have that rollout. That, to me, is specious. Mm-hmm. And I think the filmmakers felt the exact same way because, listen, when that comes out on streaming, when that comes out on HBO Max, you've got a completely pristine print of it that can just float around the internet. So if somebody wants to see it in Poland, they don't have to go to the theater. They can just torrent it.
Before I let you, before we leave this subject, have the unions gotten involved? WGA, PGA, Producers Guild, SAG-AFTRA?
You know, a lot of the unions and a lot of the directors and a lot of these production companies have been pissed. What they're going to do about it, that remains to be seen, because there's a whole lot of sort of backroom wheeling and dealing now. This is what happens when you really put the cart before the horse. You know, AT&T was so determined to preserve the secrecy of this announcement and create this very splashy debut that they didn't tell any of these people. They certainly did not work in cooperation with them. You know, that's how much of a corporate priority HBO Max was for them. And the ironic thing, Allison, is that part of the reason that they're in this situation where they would consider doing something like this is because of bad branding. You know, There's a lot of people who don't even know they have access to HBO Max. People who have HBO and don't realize that HBO Max is essentially the same thing, except it has more. Same price point, you already got it if you want it. They've done such a bad job of branding that, and they launched it at a time when there was also HBO Now and HBO Go, regular HBO, HBO Max. Nobody had any idea of what this stuff meant and what, you know, there was no clarity in the marketplace. So even though this very splashy announcement was made about HBO Max, you know, that the corporate overlords had a lot of knowledge of, but nobody else in the industry did, they didn't use that announcement to really clarify, you know, the branding issue that had kept HBO Max from being, you know, a streaming service with a high penetration point in the industry. I still run into people who don't really understand what HBO Max is. So even this feels like a very expensive, wasted opportunity to clarify what this streaming service is even intended to be.
My guest is Kyle Buchanan, reporter for the New York Times. We're talking about the future of the movie industry. A lot of TV shows have resumed filming, and we've heard a bit about plot lines having to change, perhaps fewer crowd scenes. I've heard from friends who've worked on different productions that it's taking a lot longer because you have to quarantine, and then everybody has to test negative, and then the entire, you know, costuming department has to quarantine, and the actors, and it's really taking quite a bit of time. Overall, how do you think the film industry is going to tackle the making of films? What have you heard?
Honestly, though, yes, things look different if you walk onto a set, because most of the crew members will be in masks and they'll have their face shields. And yes, you'll have fewer crowd scenes because, you know, having a whole bunch of extras just come in for a day and mingle around, that just doesn't seem kosher right now. At the same time, I think a lot of these standards are being loosened, or at least people are playing sort of loose with these ideas. You know, there was some talk at the beginning of the resumption of production that, oh, you're going to have less intimacy scenes between actors. That's not really a barrier anymore. People are doing that. People are doing a lot of the things that they'd normally do and crossing their fingers and hoping for the best. Sometimes that works out. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you have, you know, your lead, in the case of Robert Pattinson, who was filming a new Batman movie, come down with coronavirus and things shut down. And honestly, right now in Los Angeles, where there's been a lot of production, obviously, a whole lot of outbreaks have happened on a lot of these television shows that have had to shut down. Not just one person, not just two people, but whole clusters of people. You know, there's only so much that you can control on a set. And, you know, no matter what, how good a job you do controlling that, people in their off hours can expose themselves to this virus inadvertently, or, you know, by being a little less strict about what they're doing and who they're interacting with. And then they take that and travel to set, and any number of things can happen. Now, you're not hearing a lot about those things, but yeah, a ton of shows this is happening on. And it's anybody's guess, really, you know, when this pandemic is going to ease, just generally speaking, but also whether the industry is just going to sort of try to barrel through all of that, you know, willing to incur both the literal costs of testing, of, you know, things taking a little bit longer, and the physical costs of people potentially getting sick or even worse.
This is a purely opinion question as someone who watches movies, who reports about movies. When you think about how writers and directors and actors how the coronavirus is going to be in COVID-19 is going to become part of storylines. This is going to become part of the fabric of filmmaking. I can't remember whom I was listening to one podcast saying, like, that person is not looking forward to the day when they're like, well, back in the days of COVID-19, it's going to be in every film. How are you feeling about what COVID-19 and coronavirus might do to the narrative, to the creative process, to how stories are told?
I know, right? There's a little bit of a too soon element mm-hmm. to it. But, you know, it's a funny thing because when we all started staying at home in the spring, I saw a lot of people tweet to the effect of, wow, the Sundance Film Festival next year is going to be filled with coronavirus quarantine movies, you know, because mm-hmm. they were basically the only things that could be shot. They could be done on a low budget. They'd only have a couple characters. Funny thing is, Sundance is happening at the end of this month in a, you know, greatly different form online. And as near as I could tell from scanning the lineup, there isn't anything like that. There might be next year. I do think it'll be hard to avoid what a major, profound event this was for the entire globe. You know, I mean, there's no way that this will be avoided as a subject for the sort of the rest of cinematic eternity. But I do think that the way people grapple with it is going to be sort of specific, you know? They will probably be stories about how this happened in the first place. We might get sort of, you know, especially in the documentary space, I expect we're going to see a flood of kind of what I call TikTok movies, you know, about, well, tell me how this snowballed and became such a major event. We'll get those in both large versions, you know, sort of spanning the globe, telling the story of, you know, governments grappling with it, and small, intimate ones about people who really bore the brunt of this epidemic. In the fiction space, I think we're going to see a lot of escapism.
I'm speaking with Kyle Buchanan from the New York Times. He's the projectionist for the New York Times at the awards season, around awards seasons. He's one of their go-to columnists. So I'm very curious. I mean, when we think about awards seasons, this is the time of year when it really starts to crank up. And, you know, it's so interesting because the Oscars this year removed the usual requirement that nominated films have a theatrical release, which obviously mm-hmm. opens up the field to streaming films to qualify. And, you know, Netflix, they had a ton. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Mank, The Five Bloods, The Trial of Chicago 7, Pieces of a Woman. Do you think we're ever going to... Is that genie out of the bottle?
That's the question everybody is asking. You know, can you put that genie back in the bottle? The idea of this divide where streaming services could compete for the Oscars, but only if they put their movies out in the theaters for what? Maybe 2 weeks? That already was a little bit of a weak sauce delineation, if you don't mind my saying. Like, you know, Netflix doing this sort of obligatory pomp and circumstance thing we're renting a theater. Oh, yeah, look, we're having a premiere. We're putting our movie out. You know, those movies don't get talked about really until mm-hmm. they debut on that streaming service. So there was already a little bit of window dressing. This, though, removes that, sort of lays it bare, and I think clarifies the question that sort of undergirds all of this, which is, what is a movie, you know? Is a movie something that comes out in theaters, or is a movie simply, you know, a piece of media that is around 2 hours, give or take, and it doesn't really matter where it debuts, just that it is shaped like a movie, you know? I think the thing to look forward to sort of, you know, anticipate an answer to this ongoing question is what movies keep coming out in theaters on the other side of this streaming or on the other side of this pandemic. You know, a lot of, I think we'll still see certain blockbusters come out in theaters. I think we'll still see low budget horror films come out in theaters because there's such a potential return on investment. But are we going to see the traditional dramas that we kind of mm-hmm. associate with the Oscars? Are those still going to be made and distributed in theaters? I have a feeling that the bulk of those are going to come out on streaming services now, especially streaming services that are chasing legitimacy via awards attention. And if those movies, if more of the movies that you'd expect to be awardsy simply aren't coming out in theaters, well, that might force the Academy's hand. It's going to be fascinating to see over this next decade as that question plays out, because it's kind of a weirdly profound question. Mm-hmm. And as weirdly profound questions often do, it's going to play out in the award space, which is often so funny to me. But, you know, when the stakes are high, big questions get asked and answered.
All right. What films are awardsy, in your opinion, when we're talking about Oscars?
Well, you named a bunch of them. It's going to be really fascinating to see if Netflix just completely swamps the competition, you know, mm-hmm. not just having the bulk of the Best Picture nominees, but probably most of the acting nominees, too, you know. That said, I think there's some non-Netflix competition to look out for. One of those is Nomadland. It's directed mm-hmm. by Chloe Zhao, who did The Writer, and it stars Frances McDormand. She's playing an older woman who, after the death of her husband, sort of becomes an itinerant worker traveling around the country. It's shot mostly, aside from McDormand, with non-professional actors on location, and it's really moving and touching. And I hope that finds an audience. The thing I worry about with some of these Oscar movies is that, you know, you kind of want to be held captive by them in a theater. You want to lose yourself to them. Watching Nomadland at 11 a.m. in your living room as sunlight is streaming in and you're getting push notifications about something Donald Trump did, it's a different experience. So a lot of the sort of more intimate Oscar movies might suffer from that. I think another one to watch out for is a film called Judas and the Black Messiah. It stars Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield, and it's about the assassination of Fred Hampton, Black Panther's leader, and it's pretty incredibly performed and definitely a movie that speaks to where we are and where we just were in 2020.
Well, first of all, Lakeith Stanfield makes everything better.
And Daniel Kaluuya in this is ferocious. He's incredible.
And I have a glasses half full observation about the Oscars. We could have a lot of female directors nominated, given that only Catherine Bigelow has ever won. Kelly Reichardt for First Cow, Kitty Green for The Assistant. You mentioned the director of Nomadland. There are a lot of films by women who I really think that we could have a lot of women directors nominated.
Listen, this could be the most diverse Oscars we've ever had. Emphasis on could. You know, there is an incredible crop of films that have mostly cast full of people of color, like One Night in Miami. It's directed by Regina King, an actress who recently won the Oscar for If Beale Street Could Talk. She's making her first film, and it stars four tremendous black actors in the roles of people like Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. And it's this really great movie that I think could see Regina King get Oscar attention in a completely different field than she did last time. Yeah, and like you said, Chloe Zhao from Nomadland, if she were to win or even be nominated, she'd be the first Asian woman in that Best Director category. Now, the only fear I have is just a sort of nagging suspicion that because we're removed of all of the usual glitz and glamour and the entire Oscar ecosystem that we usually have to sort of, you know, winnow out the wannabes from the real contenders, that voters might just default to really traditional, safe, familiar names. And in that case, we're going to see people, and I'd say that they'd have a good shot in any year, but particularly this one, we're going to see people like David Fincher, who directed Mank. We're going to see people like Aaron Sorkin, who directed The Trial of the Chicago Seven. And when it comes to new faces, we might even just see people like Florian Zeller, who is white and is making his film debut, but a very sort of traditional one in a movie called The Father that stars Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman, two, you know, very Oscar-vetted people. So I'm hoping that Oscar voters are going to sort of keep an open mind and be excited by the freshness of these contenders, but I'm just worried that they might be as safe as can be this year.
This is to be continued. We'll definitely have you back on. I've been speaking with New York reporter and projectionist Kyle Buchanan. Kyle, thanks a lot for your time today.
Of course, anytime.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.